You're listening to an exclusive podcast series brought to you by Wired for Wonder, a proud innovation by CommBank and The Moment HQ. Prepare yourself as we take you on an eye-opening journey to ignite your curiosity, foster wonderment, and send inspiration bustling through your veins. Hello and welcome to the Wired for Wonder and The Moment HQ podcast series. I'm your host, Monica Cade. Today we're joined by Rahaf Hafroush. She is a strategist, digital anthropologist and best-selling author who focuses on disruptive technology, innovation and digital culture. She is the founder of Red Thread Inc., a think tank and consulting agency on digital trends. So let's meet her now. Hi Rahaf, thanks for joining me.
Hi Monica, it's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin. Let's go back to your childhood. What did you want to be when you grew up?
Wow, you just dove right into my childhood. I will play. That's awesome. What did I want to be? I have always wanted to be a writer of all sorts of books, fiction books and romance novels and science fiction and nonfiction and biographies. I think I can't remember a time when I wasn't working on some piece of writing. So that is sort of what I've always wanted to be ever since I was a little girl.
And tell me, how was creativity fostered in your home?
Both of my parents are quite creative. My mother is an architect and my father is an engineer. And so we were constantly role-playing games and imagination games and telling each other stories. I have two sisters, an older one and a younger one, and we would always sort of be playing together. With my younger sister especially, we would spend hours, playing make-believe or dress-up. And when we first came to Canada, I'm originally from Syria, when we first came to Canada in 1989, we didn't have very much. And so I think a lot of the creativity was sort of fostered by necessity, where we didn't have a lot of toys or we didn't have a lot of stuff. And so it was up to my sisters and I to sort of create these makeshift worlds and storylines and things like that with the stuff that we had lying around, you know, like old boxes or or small stuff like that. And so there was that aspect of it. And then my father was an avid reader. He loved science fiction. And so I've grown up reading a lot about impossible things and space and the future and aliens and different universes. And I think that just spreads your ideas of what's possible as a child. And he always encouraged me to write down my ideas on paper. And so if I wasn't playing make-believe with my sister, I was creating worlds for myself, you know, in the stories that I would write. So we were sort of a very, we're a very close family, and I think it was always encouraged to play and imagine and explore, and partly out of necessity, but also partly out of just the joy of imagination.
That sounds like so much fun, to be honest. And because you were a writer at such a young age, did you create your own books at that time?
Yes. Okay. I'm going to tell you something that's a little embarrassing, but I'll tell you yes. Because I think it's funny now. But when I went home, I live in France now. I went home to Canada to clear out some of my stuff from storage, and I found, I'm not kidding you, this like novel draft that I must have written when I was like 7 or 8 or something. Mm-hmm. And it was clearly supposed to be some sort of like Harlequin romance novel, right? It was clearly supposed to be a romance novel. It was about this doctor, and she goes to this island with this other handsome doctor. But the funny thing is I clearly had like no idea about any of the romance stuff, because the most racy thing that happened was they like held hands and it was like, ooh. And so I reread that and I honestly had tears like rolling down my eyes. I was laughing so hard. I had no recollection. I probably blocked out the sheer mortification of having done that as I got older. But I think it's pretty safe to say that I've been always writing stories for myself and for whoever would read them.
That's awesome. And that's such a cool story that you have, you know, and to be able to find that again, like however many years later, it must have been such a cool experience.
Oh yeah, it was written in pencil in those like school, you know, those like lined notebooks we used to have. Like, yeah. Oh my goodness, not even on a computer, but it was just, yes, there's a lot of eraser marks, you know, they hold hands, Like I clearly had no idea what to do with these two people. So that was probably the highlight of cleaning out a storage locker room, I will tell you. But
that's awesome. Now tell me about digital anthropology. What was it that hooked you on that front?
I think what's always fascinated me about the internet is how it's changed the way that people relate to each other, whether specifically around creativity. I mean, I started, you know, when I first got onto the internet, it was during the time of AOL. And I don't know how many people remember AOL, but it was a sort of like walled garden. But they had these like walled communities, I guess, of categories. It was probably a bit of a safer way to browse the internet at the time. And I found all sorts of writing communities, and it used to, I mean, I just couldn't wrap my brain around the idea that I could be in Toronto, you know, as a 12-year-old and reading a story by another kid who was my age, who was in Australia or in France. And this idea that the notion, rather, that ideas could transcend boundaries and geography just fascinated me. And I very quickly started making friends. I had a lot of, you know, chat friends and email friends from all over the world. And then I started looking into different online communities, like fandoms. If you really loved a show, there were groups of people who also loved that show as much as you did. And it was just this notion of how we were able to create things. People were creating videos and stories and art and conversations and friendships at a time. I know it seems so normal now, but remember, this is probably like 1993 for me. So this was like very mind-boggling that you could have, that the world just seemed to be so open. And I think it was just that curiosity and that fascination with people and behavior and rituals and belief systems and the way that we were living our lives online has just always sucked me in, because, you know, as a species, we're very tribal, we're social, and to watch how those rituals and the way that we behave have been adopted online has been fantastic. We used to play video games, and, you know, we would play with people halfway around the world. And then I started researching it. And the more I researched it from a business perspective or from an anthropological perspective, the more I just kept seeing both the good and the bad. And all throughout university and even afterwards, it seemed to me that every single big thing that was happening in our world was had this foundation of technology, this foundation of internet. You know, the protests in Iran in 2009, the presidential elections in 2008, the rise of groups like Anonymous, the rise of fan fiction, the rise of self-publishing, all of these things were the one thing that connected them together was technology and the internet. And so that has always been the space that has fascinated me. And I just couldn't get enough of it. And I still can't get enough of it. So, I think it amplifies what it means to be human, both the good and the bad. And I think I almost liken it to being able to glance into people's living rooms. You know, people say things on forums that they wouldn't say out loud, that they wouldn't say in public. They share things that they might not have. And so for me, it's a way to be able to better understand ourselves and each other, that in a way that we could not do it without these tools.
So in that sense, because you've done so much research on it and you're so fascinated by it, is there anything that you've come across in regards to technology and humanity that you would like to see come to fruition in the world?
I mean, I think, honestly, one of the things that I worry about, one of sort of the darker aspects of this tribalism online, is that sometimes, and it's being driven a lot by these new algorithms that social media and search engines are using, where the internet is starting to give us things that are catered to our tastes. So if you're on Facebook, it will only show you people that it thinks you want to see or engage with. And online, you can just live your whole life with people that are just like you. And in some ways, I think that's great, a form of community, a form of connection. But in other ways, in information consumption, in news consumption, in developing a grounded and well-balanced worldview, I worry about the consequences of what happens when you're in an echo chamber where everyone is simply repeating the things that you already believe back to you. So what I would love to see, and I think it's a big question, and I don't know, I don't have the answer to this, but I would love to see is a better integration, whether it's in schools or whether it's how you teach your kids, of how to develop this well-balanced worldview, how to make sure that your feed or your news stream isn't filled with people just like you, but actually you're taking advantage of the opportunity to learn about the other, the ones that are different, the ones that believe different things, because I'm starting to see a lot more isolation where it's not even that people aren't willing to engage with that other perspective. It's that technology means that sometimes they don't even know and they don't even have the opportunity to see it. And so what I would like to see more of is us using this as an opportunity to, you know, increase understanding and tolerance, increase activism around certain issues, and maybe decrease the amplification belief set in order to, you know, just for, in order to pursue our own kind of agendas.
Do you feel that with technologically connected world, we have lost touch with one another?
Yes. Actually, I do. I mean, this is always a bit controversial to say because I want to clarify that I'm very optimistic about all the opportunities and the good things that can come from technology. But I see sometimes a lack of presence in the moment in the real world in certain situations. And I'm not talking about, oh, you're on the bus and everyone's on their phone, or if you're in the doctor's office and everyone's on their phone, because, you know, for all we know, you could be using that time to talk to your relatives around the world or, you know, whatever. What I'm talking about is you're at the coffee shop sitting face to face with a friend, and that friend isn't looking at you because they're busy on the phone. And that is really when it's one of my biggest pet peeves. It's one of my biggest things that irritates me, because that's, I feel, is a tremendous loss in connection and in relationship and in friendship. I believe that technology has a time and place, but, and maybe I'm the outdated one now, but I also believe when you're sitting face to face with another person that the phone shouldn't even be on the table. You should be focused on the person in front of you. And sometimes I worry that those little bits of connection that we're losing, I think it's going to have an impact. We're living, you know, I think it's all about, life is about being present and being mindful and sort of enjoying every moment. And if I can't have a coffee with a friend of mine because they want to be on Instagram, then what does that say about how much they value my friendship or how much they value the time that we're spending together?
I think you've totally nailed it. And I think it's just, we each need to become more aware of how we are using our technology in order to use it in a way that is supportive rather than detrimental to our face-to-face relationships. So on the topic, tell me, what do you do to switch off from technology?
Well, I have a very good group of friends and we have started setting some guidelines around technology usage. So when we're all together, there's no phones on the table. Nobody checks their phones. So it's starting to carve out periods of time where it's a tech-free zone. My husband and I often on the weekends will just leave our devices at home and go spend the day outside doing something. I will try to carve out, like, basically it's all the same. What I do is I carve out periods of pure disconnection where I don't have to be, where I don't need to be connected. And I think a lot of that has to come from an acceptance of, you know, of getting over FOMO, or as I like to say, moving FOMO to JOMO, which is fear of missing out to joy of missing out. It's recognizing that just because you can see what everyone else is doing all the time doesn't necessarily mean that you should want to be doing all of those things at the same time too, right? So it's just, that's really all it is. And I don't think it's groundbreaking. I don't think it's difficult. I just think that the technology has moved so fast that our behaviors have been adapted so fast that we've never really stopped to think about, you know, is this what we want to be promoting as a society? Mm. When I was growing up, there was no devices at the table ever. Mm. It was unheard of. And even to this day, there's no devices at the table. And to go to a restaurant now and to see a family and you see a little kid with an iPad, you know, and I'm not commenting on anyone's parenting. Like, I get it. It's a great tool it could be a great help. But sometimes I just think to myself, like, as a child, there were uncomfortable dinners when I didn't want to be there and we were fidgeting and we were, you know, but looking back as a grown up now, looking back at those times are so important to me. I remember the fact that as a family, we tended to, as much as possible with people's schedules, always try to eat meals together. Mm-hmm. And that as a grown up is something that has become more and more valuable to me, you know, as I live away from home and my parents are older now. So I think it goes back to this idea of just constantly questioning the role that we want technology to play in our lives. And we should use it when it helps us, but we should also, as you said earlier, recognize when it's costing us something and just make sure that we're willing to pay that price. Because if you're willing to pay that price, live your life. I believe everyone should just do whatever they want to do as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. But if you recognize that there's a cost to friendships, to quality time, to your sleep, to your attention span, to your ability to sit down and read a good book, then that's something that you can very quickly change.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now tell me, you were part of Obama's digital team during the 2008 presidential elections. What was that experience like?
That is probably one of the coolest things that I've ever had the opportunity to be a part of. Mm-hmm. I was like 22, 23, just a young kid, you know, going to have this opportunity to go down to Chicago and just found myself in the middle of a team of incredibly bright and talented people. So already I was just soaking knowledge from every single person that I was surrounded by. I had never, in Canada, the political system is nowhere near as intense as in the US. So to get thrown into something where it just felt the narrative at the time was the stakes were so high. You know, this was groundbreaking. It was America's first African-American president. It was like, it just felt so traumatic. And it was very much like it felt like a do or die situation, you know, where all of a sudden I would be reading polls and reading things about this, you know, about this political system. And then I was very much touched and inspired by the members of his team, many of them who had left jobs at Google and Facebook and these high paying jobs to come and volunteer and to be a part of history. I think that was sort of an act of civic engagement that I really respected. And then finally, to be able to stand in Grant Park after the elections, after the results were announced, to be able to hear President Obama take the stage and to recognize that I was living a part of history. Hmm. I mean, I just thinking about it, I can still remember, you know, how fast my heart was beating and how just unbelievable it felt, because on that night we stayed at the campaign headquarters pretty late, actually, because we weren't sure. People forget, but we actually, it was such a tight race that we weren't sure how it was going to go. Mm-hmm. And so once we finally got the votes and we knew we had it, it was just euphoric. And they put us on this bus, all the campaign staff, or this, I think it was actually a trolley. And we just went and we had these like police escort that took us all the way to Grant Park. And we're approaching the park and maybe even like a kilometer outside was just like crowds of people, like a mass of bodies and people and energy and cheering and the noise, and it was like crackling in the air. And then we zoomed in the back and all of a sudden they like put us into the staff sort of area, and we were right in the middle of it. I was maybe, you know, 50 feet away from the podium where President Obama took the stage. And so that was kind of huge. And then the next day, going into the campaign headquarters and having President Obama phone in, and he gave this just eloquent and beautiful speech thanking meeting everybody. And then, you know, I had the opportunity to take some of the campaign posters off the wall. We have mm-hmm. them framed. They're actually in my apartment here. Mm-hmm. It was just, I think it was a testament to what happens when technology is being used by a group of people to do good in the world. And it mm-hmm. really cemented in my mind the potential of a real world action, especially since, again, in 2008, this was a time when we were just starting to use Twitter and just starting to use Facebook, and we hadn't really made the case for why did this matter for the real world. So the Obama campaign was really the first organization to translate social media into measurable real world change. And I think that just changed the landscape for businesses and political campaigns to come.
Mm, amazing. It sounds like such a wonderful experience, and it sounds like you had a really great time as well. Okay, tell me, you've got a new book that you're currently writing, is that correct? Hustle and Float?
Yes.
Tell me about this.
So Hustle and Float is essentially what we've been talking about today during this interview, where I wanted to explore some of the reasons around why we behave the way that we do around work. Why is it that we're always so busy or we feel overwhelmed when the solutions seem so easy, right? Just meditate, just schedule your time, just turn off your phone. And yet, despite the ease of these solutions, so many of us don't do those things. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to know why. And it started off as just a question. It ended up being a 2-year research project, deep diving into everything, including the history of productivity, the history of creativity, the evolution of our beliefs around contemporary work culture. All of these pieces that tell our history of how we got to the place that we are right now in terms of work. And what I've discovered is that we have this belief system around the way that we work, where if we don't start to address some of those issues, we tie our work to our self-worth, we tie our work to our identity. This whole notion of the American dream in a lot of, you know, European sort of and North American countries, this idea that if you just work hard enough, you can make it. There are these complicated systems that have been, or concepts rather, that have been evolving along with us. And if we don't understand them, and if we don't understand the drawbacks of productivity and the drawbacks of creativity and how these two systems are working together, then I think we're just going to continue to run into the same problems over and over again with our work. And I'll give you a very, very super brief example, which is when you look at the evolution of productivity, we talk about it now. Personal productivity has become a thing that exists now, right? Inbox zero and managing your time and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But productivity was originally developed by the military and by governments in order to get large groups of people to do the same type of tasks, standardized work. And as companies borrowed from that, it was all about this idea that it was used to manage large groups of people. And then eventually, the focus has been narrowing and narrowing until we get to where we are today, which is now the individual has become responsible for their own productivity. If you don't have enough time, you just need the right system, you just need the right tool, you just need the right framework. And it's all become your responsibility to get things done. Creativity, on the other hand, has always been an individual pursuit, all the way back in the Greek Roman era, all during the Romantic period, all the way through. It has been something that you, first it was something you received from the gods, then it was something that you had, then it was something that you were, and now it's become something that we do. Because as work has become more creative in the knowledge economy, we now expect people to be more creative and to problem solve and do different types of tasks. So you have creativity that's gone from something that was meant for the individual that has now been co-opted into a business tool, so from small to big. And you have productivity that started out for big groups of people that has been focused on the individual. So it's gone from big to small. And the two of them are intersecting together in modern day work. And they're actually systems that are fundamentally opposed to each other. Mm. Productivity is about constant output. Creativity is about large unstructured time. Mm-hmm. And yet we're taking them in our day-to-day jobs and we're mashing them together without recognizing that it's not working. Yeah. And so this is sort of the whole idea, is I'm trying to understand how we got here, why we think this way, what do we know now about the brain and productivity, and then hopefully to look at some solutions, because for creatives, we are being overworked and we're not sleeping enough and we're not taking care of our health enough. And I think it's starting to suffer. We're starting to suffer. And I want to put a change to that.
Sounds like an amazing project and an amazing read as well. When can the listeners expect to be able to grab the title?
It will be out next year. I will be speaking about it at Wired for Wonder this year, Sydney and in Melbourne. So very excited about that. And then they can sign up if you go to my website, which is just rahafharfouche.com, and sign up for the newsletters. I always send out excerpts or research notes or sort of exclusive content about that. And the subscribers will sort of always get that news first. So
fantastic. Some goodness there. Just before we wrap up, I have some signature questions for you.
Okay.
So tell me, what do you believe is your greatest asset?
I think my greatest asset is I'm really, really stubborn and I just don't stop. If I want something, I just will not stop until I get it, regardless of the obstacles and regardless of the setbacks. And I think that has really helped me. So I think that, and just the just always being very curious, always kind of questioning and asking why and being very curious. I think those two things have been a tremendous help to me in my career.
Beautiful. And tell me, what are you afraid of?
I don't know. Gosh, so many things sometimes. The older you get, I feel like the more afraid you get of things. I think I'm afraid of not having the chance to do or to write all of the things that I want to write about.
Wow. Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really like powerful, that one got me quite deeply there. That is like, wow. I know, cause we kind of live our lives expecting, I think unconsciously expecting that we're going to live our entire life. And yet we don't really know how long we have. And yeah, we have all this stuff inside of us that so often we put off and think, oh, I'll do that later. I'll do that next year. Or I'll try that another time. When really it's like we've only got now. So if there's little dreams burning inside of us, we should take action on them.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly it. I think you have to be always aware, and this maybe sounds a little morbid, so I hope it people understand when they hear that, but I've always sort of been very aware of like our own mortality, you know what I mean? Just sure. how fast life goes, how limited it is, how fast time seems to pass. And so I always just think to myself, you know, I just want to take advantage of every minute that we're here to just to live the best possible life, you know? And part of that is having an outlet for your creativity and for the things that I believe that we were put on this earth to do. So,
all right, last question. Tell me, if you had a superpower, what would it be and why?
If I had a superpower, what would it be and why? I would love to be able to just to speak and understand all languages. I think that would be my favorite. I love reading, and I think my curiosity around other cultures is a never ending thirst. So I don't know. I think I would love to be able to pick up any book in any language and be able to read it. I find languages to be so beautiful and such a window into the heart of a culture. And sometimes I just feel like it's like having a door to a room that you can't go into. So I would love to not only be able to read any book, but I would love to be able to speak to any person in their, you know, native tongue. I think that would be such a beautiful thing. I think that's what I would love to be able to do.
I love that superpower. I've never heard someone say that, and it's awesome. Really cool.
The plan B is just to move things with my mind because I'm lazy, and then I just won't have to get off the couch to move the remote. But that doesn't seem quite as great as, you know, the ability to understand cultures. But, you know, they compete. It depends on my mood on which one I would go for at that given moment. So
you're totally right. Awesome. Well, it was such a delight chatting with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.